Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Guns are now allowed in schools with school board approval, but in Evanston, some say the district is moving too fast.
It feels like we jumped out of a 100-story building and we didn't check for the elevator first.
Lots of scientists depend on Wyoming's public lands to do their research.
It's amazing. I love field work.
And a story about a proposed coal bailout.
These plants might get paid to not run. So if that happens, that does nothing at all to help workers in the coal mining industry.
Those stories and a conversation with candidate for Governor Mark Gordon on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. School staff in Wyoming can now carry concealed weapons on a district-by-district basis. A bill passed during the 2017 state legislative session gave school boards the power to decide if guns should be part of their security protocol. So far, that new policy has been adopted in two communities, Cody and Evanston. But as Wyoming Public Radio's education reporter Tennessee Watson discovered, in Evanston, there's some pushback.
If it's a half day of school, I get a text, an email, a voicemail. It's a half day hat day. Send a dollar so your kid can wear a hat.
But Sheila McGuire, the mother of two Uinta County School District No. 1 students, says as the district considered arming staff over the last year, there wasn't the same level of communication.
If it's something silly, like let your kid wear a hat to school, I get three messages. But a survey over whether we should arm our teachers, we get one email that never even uses the word arms or firearms or guns. It's a school safety survey.
McGuire heads up the state's Parent Teacher Association, and she's a local reporter. She's more dialed into what's happening than most. There are more than 2,000 students in the district, but just over 250 parents and community members responded to the survey about guns in schools. Amy Grenfell is a regular participant in the district parent advisory team organized by Superintendent Ryan Thomas. She's weighed in on everything from scheduling to how the high school valedictorian gets selected. But when guns came up,
I did at that point voice my concerns of like, ooh, I don't know. There's a lot to think through here on this one. And there are other parents in attendance who were more positive about this topic. And that was the last I ever heard of it.
It's been a heartbreaking year of shooting after shooting, and educators across the nation are desperate for concrete ways to make schools safer. Grenfell says instead of engaging the community in a broad conversation about solutions, district administrators were locked in on concealed carry.
It feels like we jumped out of a 100-story building and we didn't check for the elevator first. Like, instead of us being the first to pass this policy, why couldn't we be the first to creatively, cohesively, community-wide come up with a workable solution? Maybe that workable solution ended up resulting in this. I don't know, but the process is what I would like to be proud of.
Grenfell says she fears this has more to do with politics and less to do with student safety. In fact, former and current state lawmakers from Uinta County have been the major drivers behind efforts to do away with gun-free zones altogether, but those bills haven't passed. So the fight to expand the Second Amendment is happening on a district-by-district basis. Superintendent Ryan Thomas says it would have been easier if the legislature had just made the decision.
And I don't want to place blame, but what's happened is the school district has been put in the middle of these parents.
Thomas says about 30% of the population is still opposed to the idea of bringing guns into schools, and around 20% are undecided.
So for 30% of our population, we're bad guys, when all we're really trying to do is provide a safer environment for our students and our staff.
Thomas says the district also plans to do more staff and employee training to retrofit entrances to make them more secure and to install a new communication system. But teachers are still concerned. Teacher Susan Anderson says the majority of school shooters are students, and she wrestles with the idea of teachers being willing to kill kids.
And I've had other teachers approach me and say, well, what if they're hurting other kids? And I tell them the same response, I will do everything in my power to get those kids out of there.
And she says there are unanswered questions, like who will help kids escape if teachers are focused on shooting an attacker? And what if a parent doesn't want their kid in a classroom with a gun? The night of the policy's final vote, board members still had uncertainties about teacher duties and responsibilities.
If our board members have questions, why not just say, hey, let's table this, let's do some more research, talk to more people.
But instead of opting for more discussion, the board passed the policy that night.
After it passed, I just was pretty upset and went on the job vacancies for the Wyoming School Association and found there was a job in Mountain View and decided to apply for it.
And this fall, she'll start that new job in the neighboring district you went to for. And she's sure that concealed carry will come up there too, but she's hoping the district takes a different approach. And there are districts taking their time to think through what to do. Greg Borcher, Park No. 1 school board chair up in Powell, says they discussed concealed carry all winter long, and the community remained split.
It is, as a board member, it's not an easy decision because it is a highly emotional and very little data, because we're typically making our decisions on sound data, and on this subject, there's really no data that shows one way or the other would be the best.
So in April, they decided to table the gun discussion and develop a more comprehensive plan that includes building improvements, training, interagency cooperation, and he says most importantly, a way to address social, emotional, and mental health on an ongoing basis. And in Evanston, parents are still fighting to slow the process down. A petition to delay implementation of the policy was submitted to the board in May, and a lawsuit filed earlier this month alleges the district failed to give adequate notice of the final policy before it was approved. The suit asks for an injunction to prevent the policy from moving forward until that case is resolved. The Wyoming Department of Education is planning a school safety summit for mid-August to help districts take a more comprehensive approach. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
As previously reported, the state of Wyoming is trying to figure out what to do about issues related to prison overcrowding and public safety. Mark Pelka is the deputy director of the Council of State Governments Justice Center, who's helping the state find ways to deal with offenders earlier in life and find ways to keep recently released inmates from violating parole or probation. He was in Cheyenne this week as part of a conference dealing with these topics and others. Pelka's project is called Justice Reinvestment.
Justice Reinvestment is a data-driven process that states use to identify what factors are driving growth in crime, recidivism, correction populations, and enact policies to avoid growth and shift some savings into public safety strategies. So it's a framework that states customize to address their specific challenges.
Wyoming certainly has some challenges cost-wise. When I listen to you talk to them, it sounds like this could be quite a comprehensive approach to try and change things around. Do they need to make some changes in the state, do you think?
Absolutely. It's the commitment of state leaders to launch this process that gives emboldens the Council of State Governments Justice Center staff to pursue data wherever it's available, talk to people in the justice system wherever they are, and put forward a set of policy options that reflect the full scope of the criminal justice system. The justice system is interconnected at all these points across state and local government, courtroom, prison, jail, police department, and more. So any policy framework moving forward needs to account for pressures felt really anywhere in Wyoming's criminal justice system. I think the real standout point today in the public safety forum was the role of behavioral health. It was almost, the discussion today was almost equal parts behavioral health and criminal justice. We had community behavioral health centers saying that one half of people receiving services in their centers are people referred by probation and parole. On the other hand, you hear the criminal justice system say there are people who are failing on probation and parole because they're not completing their treatment. These are populations driving cost in both systems, so let's identify opportunities for the two systems to collaborate.
They talk about both sides, that maybe we can use technology, maybe we can use some innovative approaches. What do you think might work here?
I think real-time data could inform policy in ways in Wyoming that would direct you toward the specific, pinpoint the areas that are driving growth and cost and population and recidivism. There's limited bandwidth available for policy changes in Wyoming, so the data-driven process of justice reinvestment will home in on the areas that are driving substantial growth in your population. The science around proven practices to reduce recidivism has never been clearer in criminal justice. We know more than ever before about the time at which most people reoffend on probation, the types of factors that contribute the most to recidivism, and the interventions that can reduce recidivism by the greatest amount. So if you're looking in Wyoming to both avoid cost and increase public safety, that's the area to really drill into.
It seems still, though, that you're going to have some pushback from people that say, hey, they're criminals. The heck with all this. We'll spend our money elsewhere. How do you overcome that?
In many states, corrections spending is the Pac-Man of the budget. It goes up and up, consuming more resources, and it creates these catch-22s almost, where resources that could go into effective programming, effective supervision, supporting law enforcement efforts to reduce crime, wind up going into the hidden costs of corrections. And so what states find themselves doing is reacting to recidivism when in fact they could move those resources upstream and avoid that costly revocation from probation and parole, avoid that costly prison bed, and avoid recidivism, public safety costs.
What would be best approach for the state if they want to develop a plan and be successful with it finally?
I think look at the projected growth in your prison population in Wyoming. Right now, your prisons are essentially full. People are backing up into county jails under contracts. People are being housed in Mississippi and private prisons. And the prison population is projected to grow. So you have a five-year projection available about where your system is and where it will be 5 years from now. There's a cost associated with accommodating that. Maybe more contract beds out of state, building a new facility, packing more people into prison. So maybe a plan in Wyoming could help identify the policies to avoid that growth, to bend that curve, and that'll provide you with some avoided costs that if you could move those, make those reinvestments, you can, achieve the goals of that public safety plan.
They have to move fast, though. I mean, that's part of this, right?
Yes. There are two more meetings for the Joint Judiciary Committee. November is the final meeting, and the goal is to have a policy package ready for the next governor, the next legislature, the next chief justice in early 2019. So a staff from the Council State Governments Justice Center will be on site frequently, will be analyzing data intensively and extensively engaging people in the justice system to meet that target. These windows, these openings happen only so often in states when the leaders of all three branches come together. So the justice reinvestment approach can enable them to capitalize on that momentum.
Good luck on all of this, Mark. Mark Pelka, thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it very much, Bob.
When we come back, Bob Beck will speak with another Republican candidate for governor, Mark Gordon. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming State Treasurer Mark Gordon is looking for a promotion. Gordon is among those who are seeking the Republican nomination for governor. Before first being appointed treasurer following the death of Joe Meyer, Gordon was a Johnson County rancher and a small businessman. He tells me that he got into this race for a variety of reasons, including finding creative ways to enhance Wyoming's revenue while trying to help the state live within its means.
I pushed very hard this year and think that we need to continue to reduce our spending. There are some cuts, I think, that come, but I don't think it can be done on a kind of blanket, let's cut 10% here or something else. I think we really have to take a look from the bottom to the top. I've recommended we start with the Constitution. What are the things that we need to do constitutionally? Then we can start building it out and build a little bit stronger culture that is cost conscious. And I think that's an effort we're just going to have to engage with.
Education, is that an area where you would continue the process of looking for cuts there as well?
Yeah, I think, Bob, on education, each school district is different. We've talked a little bit in the office about how do we get more current income. Then I think I go to the school districts, I look at Bighorn 1, for example, and they say, boy, we could consolidate. You go to Park 16, a whole different matter. And so I think letting school districts themselves and their boards getting some more accountability, get a little bit more local control, and really push, and I've tried to do this the last couple of years, push exactly what the circumstances are. The conversation so far has been, well, we've got $20 billion, Mr. Treasurer, you talk about that on a regular basis. Why are we talking about cutting? The fact of the matter is, and I think you and I have talked about this, that $20 billion is really broken down in three pies. The Permanent Mineral Trust Fund, can't spend that. Mm-hmm. What's there for education, that's what's going to fund it, and the state agency pool, and we have a whole bunch of other things out of that. So I think getting realistic about what the funding future is and letting those districts come to their own conclusions about how to make some cuts there. And then I think also this efficiency study has some things that could be looked at.
Well, and I want to ask you, in your view, what is reality when it comes to the revenue future when you suggest there's maybe a $1 billion deficit down the road facing us as far as revenue coming in? Are there ways we can fix that? Are there anything we can do? Or are we just going to have to figure out a way to come up with $1 billion?
Well, we have sort of figured out a way to come up with $1 billion, at least for a short time. And that's my big concern here, is how sustainable is that?
Right.
You know, we dug in on many of the so-called coffee cans this year to do the House solution, and then we have the LISRA a year out. My biggest problem, Bob, is that we are borrowing from the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund. We're borrowing from the Common School Fund. We do this with a 0% interest rate payback, and so we're really robbing from future generations. That's got to stop. I think you've got to sort of take a serious look at that efficiency study. Reportedly, there's $200 million that can be found there. There's more that can happen a little bit. A good conversation about that could be helpful. I also think that just getting serious about what are the things that we absolutely have to do at this particular juncture, and then setting up funds that that can help address those costs in the future, I think, are two possibilities we can have, but it does mean we're going to have to cut back on some of the stuff we do today.
Mark Gordon visiting with us. Everybody's lining up on the Republican side, I noticed, to talk about wanting to have taxes. I'm teasing, of course, but are you holding off on that discussion as well?
The tax question in Wyoming is an interesting one. Obviously, 70% of our tax income comes from the mineral industry. We've, in our office, worked that we just finished the Atlas Carbon deal, value-added proposition, activated charcoal. It's going to go out of state. It's actually going to add to the tax benefit. There was a story recently about, as we diversify the economy, our tax is going to be carried into that. That was actually work that the treasurer was commissioned under statute, that we commissioned with regard to one of the economic development loans that we were looking at. I wanted to make sure that got out into the public so that we have a real discussion about that. I don't believe we need to raise taxes. I do think we need to diversify the tax structure somewhat. And, seems like that's something Governor Mead's talking about too. But I think we have to have that conversation going forward.
In other words, making it more fair.
I think, yeah, we have to discuss that. What is fair, and how do we make it more fair?
Wondering your thoughts on diversifying the economy, and just maybe a direct question: are you a fan of Endow? Are you supporting those efforts, and would you continue to support that as you move forward if you get elected?
Two answers to that. One is, I think there are some pieces of Endow that are incredibly important. The broadband initiative is obviously one. It's a little unclear how the air service initiative is going to fare. There's a question about sustainability. Overall, I think it's a good effort, and I think it will make a difference for a lot of communities, Riverton and Rock Springs, that are going to have challenges coming forward to make sure they have that air service that's so vital to their mm-hmm. economic future. But I've mentioned this before. Back in the 1980s, my boss at Apache Corporation, oil and gas company, put a lot of money into something called the Wyoming Futures Project. And we had huge focus groups, and he even took over the Casper Events Center for a statewide conversation about what we were going to do with the economic future. Virtually none of the recommendations were ever put in place. I asked Raymond about that recently, and he said, Mark, you know, it was never really about those recommendations. It was about having the conversation. And in that respect, you know, Wyoming needs to have this conversation. We need to diversify our economy.
But you also had the conversation, then absolutely nothing happened. How do we make sure that these suggestions go forward and maybe implement some of the things that obviously make sense?
Well, I wouldn't agree with you that nothing happened. I mean, we built a business in Sheridan that was a mail order catalog business that was affiliated with a very large international tour organization, Abercrombie and Kent, and it was because of many of the things that were found in that study. One of the things they said is that for all these energy executives that are there, there are spouses that are highly educated, looking for things to do, anxious to try to build enterprises. And so from my standpoint, it identified lots of opportunities. I am not a big believer in government being able to solve these problems. I think government can underlay what the foundations ought to be, but I don't think government should be trying to figure out what's going to work here or what's not. That's going to be the province of entrepreneurs and people like myself. We built our business and grew it. We also expanded into agriculture. Mm-hmm.
Mark Gordon visiting with us again. He's one of your Republican candidates for governor. Want to ask you a little bit about one area that I think a lot of people, when they talk about economic development, they circle and say is a problem in our state, and it's about healthcare. What are we going to do about the fact that you've just got these large areas where you can't get mental health services, you can't get daily healthcare services? What are we going to be able to do about that?
Well, I've served on the Northern Wyoming Mental Health Center. I know exactly some of the challenges that we have. We served Johnson, Sheridan, Crook, and Weston counties, the remote services, and so on. People often talk about how great telemedicine is, and I think it is truly telemedicine. But if I've got somebody who's, you know, 90 miles away on a Skype connection, that may not be the most ideal circumstance. Also serve on Volunteers of America. I look at this a little bit differently. I know we have challenges and we're going to have to address those. I think there are some things you can look at in Alaska where they've taken some of the medical challenges like pregnancy and so on and made a conscious decision. How can we help lower those premiums for that? You can look at what Butch Otter's done over in Idaho and talk about the skinny plans and are there some possibilities to be able to do better coverage? All of those ought to be looked at. But I come back to saying the medical centers in our counties are often some of the largest employers that we have. And when you think about what's happening in medicine generally, you know, the VA started a few years ago with allowing veterans to get their pacemakers hooked up to the cell, to their phones, and they could monitor their health. And now as we look at rural delivery, a state like Wyoming offers an incredible opportunity to be able to not only develop the hardware and the software, but also the response mechanisms and the models that can allow places like Sage West and Riverton to service places in Dubois. And maybe that means setting off some assets, physician's assistants or something else that can be responsive, but building the kind of technology that that they're looking at where I can put my thumb on a sensor of some sort and it can give me a reading of what my vital stats are.
But the mental health thing, though, continues to be this huge problem, and I just came from a discussion on our corrections future. Lots of concern about providing more services to people, both to keep them from going to prison and those who are violating their probation and parole. You've got this huge suicide issue that we've all talked about for years and years and years. This just seems like a piece that has to be addressed in some way. Do you argue that it's not a government issue, or what do you think about that?
No, I think this is absolutely something we've got to address. Young man in KC just a couple of weeks ago, back from two tours in Iraq, took his own life, sadly, not long after he was married. And, you know, it happened in Texas, but that's the sort of story you hear often here, and nationally, I think the Veterans Association has got to address this in a better way. Here in the state of Wyoming, as I've said, with Volunteers of America, we've looked at what are the ways that we can address some of these issues. A piece of it is about spirituality. A piece of it is about having the resources available locally. And I think it is a commitment we've got to do. It's actually a cost savings in some ways, because if we can treat somebody in place, in the community they know, with the people around them that they know and that love them, often we can avoid having to institutionalize them or send them somewhere for treatment. So I think that whole model has to be looked at. We've looked at it for years, but that doesn't mean we have a solution or there isn't a solution that's available.
Mark Gordon, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, we hear about the importance of golden eagles and talk about a coal bailout. This is Open Spaces.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. A new permanent exhibition at the Draper Natural History Museum at the Buffalo Bill Center of the West focuses on golden eagle research, but it also looks at how golden eagles have been and still are significant to the Plains Indian people. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska has more.
Awed, he stood looking up at the extraordinary drawings. Then he strolled along slowly, searching the island for the flower. In his deep slumber that night, he had a vision of a radiant figure standing beside him, singing a medicine song. His outstretched hands had held a breathing, luminous golden eagle. Plucking a feather from the wings, he had put it on the head of Batsigoyo, the bald one, and ascended to the cliff and disappeared.
That was Lynette St. Clair, of the Shoshone Nation, reading an Eastern Shoshone oral story passed along by elders of the tribe, signifying the golden eagle as a gift from the Creator. This story is specific to the Eastern Shoshone, but Dr. Emerson Bull Chief of the Crow Tribe says the significance of the golden eagle, and in general animals, applies to most Native tribes.
And so we have this relationship with animals where we see them as equal. They tell us things and they give us their powers for help, and we help them. And so there's this symbiotic relationship between humans and animals.
The connection between animals and Native cultures started before anyone can really remember. Rebecca West, the curator of the Plains Indian Museum, says Native cultures were efficient at surviving in a harsh and unforgiving ecosystem.
So you have to remember that raptors, like the golden eagle, were something that was not just a pretty bird to admire and to study. This was something that they lived alongside and lived with and respected as part of their environment.
The eagle and other parts of nature were all powerful, and Native cultures respected their spiritual powers like those of a golden eagle.
And that relates to its ability of course, flight. It's one of the highest flying birds. Its amazing eyesight, and also its ability to hunt.
Bull Chief says if every Native American respects and gives reverence to the animal, it provides protection. But to a certain few, golden eagle feathers can be medicine.
If you go on a vision quest where you have medicine that pertains to it, then you're more respectful to that animal. There's that knowledge of it and revering it, and then there's the level where you gotta give even more respect if that's part of your medicine.
Medicine not within the boundaries of our modern definition. To Native Americans, medicine is the presence and power embodied in a person, place, or object. And to some, the golden eagle feather can be medicine. The importance of golden eagles has also been noted by researchers along some rock art cliffs with eagle nests nearby. Bonnie Lawrence Smith is the curatorial assistant at the Draper Natural History Museum.
It is a vertical cliff face sandstone, so it is covered in that really pretty dark, what they call desert varnish, but it creates this beautiful sort of canvas for petroglyphs to be carved into to be really, really visible.
In 2013, Smith was out scouting Golden Eagle Nest with Draper Museum volunteers and saw petroglyphs of golden eagles.
Is that coincidental? And is it coincidental that we have these raptor petroglyph rock art images right underneath these nesting golden eagles? I don't know.
The site is called Legend Rock. It's a sacred place to many tribes, as groups of natives would travel there to perform spiritual or medicinal ceremonies. And at the site, there is a petroglyph of a golden eagle. To Smith, this could potentially mean that tribes intentionally went looking for places where golden eagle nests existed in order to have a closer connection with the creator.
There's mythologies that talk about the creator, and when you see the images on the wall, you know the creator's nearby. And so that ties into it. There's like a spirituality. It was not something taken lightly.
Smith is still going out to site locations of rock art to see if there are golden eagle nests nearby. The hope is there is a large enough number of sites that could lead to potentially prove her hypothesis. But the bottom line is the golden eagle matters. Jen Runs Close to Lodge is a Lakota tribal member, but has lived on the Wind River Reservation for the majority of her life.
Whenever you see one, it makes you, I guess it's almost an overwhelming emotion that you feel.
She says she gets choked up because natives identify with golden eagles so much. The exhibit is currently open. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kudelska at the Center of the West in Cody.
Over the next few weeks, we're going to take you on a tour of some of our favorite public lands. Today's tour will be in the company of an entomologist who relies on public lands to study bees, in particular, the disappearing western bumblebee. Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen met up with her at Curt Gowdy State Park.
Most people visit this park in southeastern Wyoming for the world-class mountain biking, reservoirs filled with rainbow trout, and hikes through steep granite formations. But entomologist Christy Bell comes here for the bees.
It's amazing. I love field work.
She says it's hard to imagine doing her research without the abundant public lands in our region.
It would be extremely more difficult because we would have to rely on private landowners allowing us on their land. A lot more paperwork, even with the permits.
Like all entomologists, Bell has to collect her specimen in order to study it. Last summer, she set up bee traps on public lands across western Wyoming. This summer, her attention is on eastern Wyoming.
We'll have some 12, 15-hour days, and it's exhausting, but oh god, just being out here and like hanging out with bees and stuff is it's so worth it. I love it. It's my favorite thing.
Bell is trying to figure out where the elusive and possibly endangered western bumblebee lives in the region. It used to be found in a number of western states, but not anymore.
There have been populations found in the Rockies, and they seem pretty stable, but nobody has looked for this bee in Wyoming.
Except for her. She says she found a few healthy-seeming populations in western Wyoming. Now it's eastern Wyoming's turn. We've doused ourselves in sunscreen and bug spray and are walking through a low-lying meadow towards rolling hills green with spring rain. The sun is out and so is the wind as we trek up a hill towards Belle's first trap.
So we set out three sets of traps at each site, and I kind of try to get them in different areas. So this one is on a hillside surrounded by a lot of mountain mahogany. The ones down there are a little bit more in the stream bed area. And then we have the third set over there in the trees.
The trap is three plastic cups zip-tied to a steel stake that's stuck into the ground. It's easy to spot, and that's by design. The cups are painted bright blue and neon yellow to look like wildflowers, so they'll attract the bees. But when the insect lands in the cup, they're trapped in diluted soapy water.
Oh, we got a bee in this one.
There's also some moths, butterflies, spiders, and some flies. Belle uses a coffee filter to dump the water out of the cup without losing any of the bugs.
It's really, really fancy scientific stuff right here.
If the bees aren't already dead in the soapy water, they soon are when Belle packs them into labeled containers with cyanide. We head off towards her next trap when a bumblebee whizzes by us. Belle is quick and catches it with her insect net.
Oh my gosh, it's huge. Yeah, they're queens. So hard when it's windy.
This queen bee is almost the size of a quarter.
I think this might be my bee. Yeah.
What do you mean?
what I think this might be a Western bumblebee.
Belle grabs a clear vial out of her fanny pack and uses the slack in the net to guide the bee into the tube. Then she holds it up to the light and takes a closer look.
Oh, this is not my bee.
So how do you know?
Western bumblebees have really pale white fur on the very ends of their abdomen. And as you can see, her stripe on the abdomen is yellow with some black behind it.
So what now?
I'm going to take a bunch of pictures of her in the vial, and then I'll let her go. Do you see how she has some pollen on her back legs?
Yeah.
Those little light patches? So this means that this queen does have an established nest.
Belle will go through this process over and over again this summer, trapping, collecting, and identifying bees, and almost all of her work will take place on public land like Kurt Gowdy State Park. Eventually, Belle's work will help inform U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services as they decide whether to put the Western bumblebee on the endangered species list. In the meantime, Belle says she's just happy to be outside.
The places that I get to go to, yeah, the things that I get to see are just phenomenal.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
The Trump administration has confirmed a bailout to the coal and nuclear industries is in the works. A memo from the Department of Energy was recently leaked outlining the plan. It would force utilities to buy electricity from retiring coal and nuclear plants to keep them alive for 2 years. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim speaks with University of Richmond law professor Joel Eisen, who's written extensively on energy and the electric grid, to help make sense of what a coal bailout would mean for Wyoming and the country.
What we know is that there is a memo from the Department of Energy that suggests that two federal statutes, the Defense Production Act and the Federal Power Act, be used to justify payments to coal and nuclear plants that are on a specific list of designated plants. And it's important to note that all we have right now is a memo that suggests that action will be taken.
So they set out in their outline a two-year timeline, it looks like, and one of the things they talked about in that was this vulnerability study of the grid system. What does that mean?
So the Department of Energy did a study last year in which it attempted to assess the reliability of the electric grid. And actually, the study found that the grid that we have right now is quite reliable, and the DOE's study of last year does not support action under either of these two federal statutes that are discussed in the memo. The two-year timeline that is discussed in the memo is a time frame under which the action, whatever form it takes, would be in place while the DOE continues to study what it sees as the need for further action. Let's assume for the moment that it is that action is taken according to the outline that's called for in the memo. It does two things. It directs regional grid operators to pay for energy or capacity to a list of coal and nuclear power plants. And then it directs individual utilities to buy electricity from these power plants.
So if this order does come to be, who will it help?
One thing that actually might happen here is that these plants might get paid to not run. If the bailout were to result in more coal-fired power plants running more often, then you might see increased demand for coal. But I don't think there's any guarantee that that is going to happen, at least not the way the memo is phrased.
There's already been a bailout attempt. What's different about this time?
The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, is the principal regulator of the nation's electric grid. In January, FERC rejected a request from the Department of Energy to make a federal rule that would have paid money to bail out the coal and nuclear plants. This time, if the DOE acts according to the memo, it is going to act unilaterally. That is, it's going to say that under the limited authority that it has over the grid under the Defense Production Act and the Federal Power Act, that it and it alone is taking this particular action. Using the specific authority of the Defense Production Act effectively commandeers the economy to nationalize the electric grid for up to 2 years. And that is such intervention in the market that we shouldn't sanction it unless it is most absolutely necessary, and it is certainly not necessary in this particular instance.
That was energy reporter Cooper McKim speaking with University of Richmond law professor Joel Eisen.
When we come back, we'll hear from Wyoming's congressman regarding some opioid legislation being debated in the U.S. House and what it might mean for Wyoming. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. This week, the U.S. House of Representatives focused its attention on opioids, but some lawmakers are starting to ask if the opioid crisis is taking attention away from the substance abuse issues that predate the epidemic in the West. Correspondent Matt Laszlo has the story from Washington.
The U.S. House has been voting on a slew of opioid-related bills, and they're not done. The plan is to take up more than 30. Some deal with ensuring old pills are easily and safely disposed of, while others try to ensure the government has the best data on the crisis. Still others seek to prevent drugs from flowing in through the nation's many ports of entry, whether the southern or northern borders, or via a plane or ship. Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney says the bills are necessary.
I think they're really important, and I think we have a national crisis, and I think that it's important that, you know, the People's House be focused on the kinds of issues that are having such a devastating impact on communities across the country.
While the opioid crisis is claiming as many lives a year as were lost in the entire Vietnam War, there's a growing number of voices who fear Congress is diverting attention from other more long-standing substance abuse problems.
In Alaska, it's alcohol, has been alcohol, will be alcohol.
In Montana and among Montana's Indian tribes, meth is actually more of our issue.
It's definitely the biggest problem out there.
Those are Republican Senators Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Steve Daines of Montana, and the last voice was Wyoming's own Mike Enzi, the state's senior senator. Enzi says the opioid crisis has already eaten up a lot of time on a very packed Senate schedule.
It's taking attention away from a lot of things. We've already passed 7 bills that deal with the opioid crisis, and we still have one. So there are going to have to be some different kinds of solutions.
Enzi's not saying the opioid crisis isn't worthy of attention from officials, but he says those officials helping stem the tide don't necessarily have to come from Washington.
Every problem doesn't have a federal solution. It just doesn't. And that's why probably 7 bills haven't worked.
Congresswoman Cheney begs to differ with a growing number of lawmakers out west complaining about the attention the opioid crisis is getting.
I don't think it's a distraction. I think opioids have not been as big a challenge for us right now in Wyoming as they have been in some other parts of the country. But I think it's really important, you know, for us to be focused on it. And frankly, it doesn't distract from the larger challenges that we have.
Some critics have said the myriad of bills the House is taking up are mere window dressing because GOP leaders aren't bringing up a massive emergency aid package that would shovel resources to the crisis immediately. But Cheney says those critics are wrong and that the House is doing important work right now.
We're given more tools to the community. I think that we're reflecting that some of the existing programs have got to be changed. We've got to have flexibility to make sure that people are able to get the resources they need. So I think across the board we'll take a look at it.
Still, Pennsylvania Democratic Senator Bob Casey has a bill to infuse $45 billion into what he says is potentially the worst drug epidemic the nation has ever witnessed. He also says GOP leaders' efforts to undermine so-called Obamacare and to kick people off of Medicaid shows the effort is all election year theater.
Most folks back home need resources, and they also don't need Medicaid expansion cut.
But Cheney says Democrats who just want to throw money at the problem are missing the point.
I think we have to be careful that we don't just fall into the trap of thinking more resources. We got to spend money wisely and see what we're doing now that we need to change that could help us more effectively address the crisis.
The U.S. House will continue focusing on the opioid epidemic over the next several days, and the Senate is expected to take up its own version of opioid legislation later this summer or fall. Even if many Western lawmakers are growing weary of the attention opioids are taking away from long-standing meth and alcohol problems that continue to ravage their communities. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Museums have special exhibitions. What visitors don't know is that it takes years for the exhibit to evolve from a concept to the moment you're standing in front of that famous work of art. The Whitney Western Art Museum at the Buffalo Bill Center of the West just opened its new exhibit featuring the famous Western American artist Albert Bierstadt. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska finds out, the process behind securing loans is not so easy.
Between 1867 and 1875, Bierstadt painted three different but similar paintings portraying the demise of the American bison. Karen McWhorter with the Whitney Museum says the first one is titled The Buffalo Trail.
We feel that this painting speaks to the thesis of the exhibition. It speaks to our point, being that Bierstadt witnessed the bison being decimated in the West.
As the Buffalo Trail depicts the heyday of the buffalo, the next two paintings depict the downward spiral. Although academics aren't sure if these paintings were meant to be displayed together, for this exhibit, it hits the main objective right on the nose. Bierstadt didn't only paint landscapes, he also was conscious of the bison's plight.
This was his statement, saying, look at this iconic animal. I mean, even at that time, it was, it's the largest land mammal in North America. It symbolized the West in both its numbers and its uniqueness as a species. So this was his recognition of the bison being symbolic of the wildness of the West.
The second painting, titled The Buffalo Trail, An Impending Storm, displays the incoming threats to the bison, such as the railroad and an increased human population. And the last one, Western Kansas, well, Peter Hazrick with the Buffalo Bill Center of the West explains.
It's called Western Kansas because Western Kansas is where all the buffalo are being butchered by the buffalo hide hunters. In the year 73-4, over 3.5 million hides were shipped out of Western Kansas alone.
So altogether, Bierstadt is making a clear statement with these three paintings. During his lifetime, the bison faced near extinction because of the westward expansion. And this exhibit explores exactly this, Bierstadt as a conservationist.
A sort of wake-up call for America. America did not want to be woken up. They could care less about the buffalo, and they could care even less about the Indian. Bierstadt remained sensitive to these issues throughout his career.
Ideally, the museum wanted to show all three paintings, but only got the first one. The Buffalo Trail's permanent home is at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. Elliot Davis of the Museum of Fine Arts says when McWhorter came knocking on her door to borrow the Buffalo Trail, she had different plans for it.
We're really working towards this project to look at Western art, particularly Native American art, at the time the Museum of Fine Arts opened our doors. And so the Buffalo Trail, being so well known in the Carolet Collection, was really essential to that project.
But she says every challenge presents an opportunity. So they decided to go down a different path and use another of Bierstadt's works. Yet, even though they were able to snag the first one, McWhorter says it's not unusual for a museum to be unable to lock down an important piece of artwork for a special exhibition.
Generally, the reason for decline loans is because an institution has already committed the painting to another borrower, or it's a central part of their interpretive plan. That was the response we got in a couple cases, and that's understandable.
McWhorter says because of this, curators have learned to be creative. They were missing two paintings. So they really have to think. How can they evoke the same message with just reproductions?
We've created this immersive audiovisual experience in which reproductions of the paintings will be backlit, and overhead you'll hear a narrator walking you through the paintings.
McWhorter says, in some ways, it's the best of both worlds. She says by creating an audio and visual experience, they were able to more clearly parse out the symbolism of the 19th century paintings, rather than leaving it up to the viewer to make out what it means.
Areas of the images will illuminate as we explore possible messages and meanings in Bierstadt's depictions of bison in the American West.
The exhibit runs through September 30th. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kudelska at the Center of the West in Cody.
Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. If you missed any part of the show or want to hear it again, you can find it on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
There you can also sign up for our podcast, or else you can get it where you sign up for Apple Podcasts. Anna Rader is our web editor.
Next week, we'll have a special edition of the program as I continue my I Respectfully Disagree series.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.